Good afternoon, everybody. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to the Vox Pop for Tuesday, April 11th. I'm Alan Chartok. The Syrian civil war has been ongoing for about 6 years, and a recent apparent chemical attack on civilians has been reignited. International condemnation of the conflict brutality is widespread. The U.S. responded with airstrikes on a Syrian airbase, with the Russian-backed Syrian government and many groups, including those labeled by the U.S. as terrorist forces. The Syrian war is a complicated issue. Put another way, a complicated mess. Here to discuss the complexities is a wonderful guest, Dr. Jim Steiner of the Rockefeller College of Public Affairs and Policy at the University of Albany. And we want to hear from you. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Listen to the news, and then we'll be back in a couple of seconds or so. Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Vox Pop, WMC's live daily afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Alan Chartok. The Syrian civil war started in 2011 has become one of the most difficult problems for the international community. The conflict involves the Russian-backed Syrian president Bashar al-Assad and many opposing forces, some of which the United States considers terrorist organizations. Here to discuss the complexities in the Syrian war is Dr. Jim Steiner, and are we lucky to have him, of the Rockefeller College of Public Affairs and Policy at the University of Albany. Jim is the school's program coordinator for Homeland Security, Cybersecurity, and Emergency Management. He served in the CIA, get this, folks, from 1972 to 2005, focusing on Soviet defense and economic issues. In the 1990s, Jim served in the State Department as special advisor to the ambassador at large for Russia and the former Soviet states. Could we have a better guy on with us today? Certainly not. Jim, welcome to Vox Pop.
Alan, thank you so much. Delighted to be here.
Well, it says here that you're the coordinator, program coordinator for Homeland Security, Cybersecurity, and Emergency Management. What does that mean?
Well, Alan, you know that we have a couple of programs in Homeland Security at SUNY Albany. We have the new College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity. But also in Rockefeller College and our Masters of Public Administration, we have a concentration in Homeland Security. And we go beyond Homeland Security. We do national security and global security as well.
So when you were with the agency, what'd you do? And I'd rather you didn't answer if you have to kill me if you do answer.
Not for the most part, I can put it on the table, but I can't tell you too much about flying around the jungles of Colombia. Anyway, I started out working on the former Soviet Union. I spent about 20 years doing that. And then after we won that war, I actually helped the State Department for a few years as we worked with the new independent states to try to get them on the right track. Unfortunately, we didn't do too great a job on that, but we worked at it. Then I went back to the agency. I ran the European analysis effort, including on Bosnia at that time. From there, I had a tour working for the director and helping him get ready for national security meetings where U.S. policy was made on all the issues across the spectrum. And I hope we can get a little bit into that.
Let's
today.
Do it now.
Okay.
Are you alarmed, Jim, at what you see?
Oh, very much so. Very much so. Although I will say I'm less alarmed now than I was a month ago.
That's because the generals are back in charge.
Well, somewhat because the generals are back in charge, but really because one general's not in charge and another player is now out of the room.
Right.
But the National Security Council was set up back in 1947. It was set up so that the U.S. government could have deliberative consultations with the major parts of the government involved in foreign policy and national security. And that's the Pentagon and the State Department as the key players, along with the president, the vice president, the national security advisor. And then they were advised by the director of Central Intelligence, as well as the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And that was essentially the core of the National Security Council. Now, over the years, we added to that council as issues arose. For example, in the 70s, we added the Secretary of Energy because we realized energy was a vital national interest and we needed it. The bottom line is this is a well-honed machine that works at a fairly low level initially to put together programs to formulate and implement policy, goes through what's called the deputies, where the number two people at these major agencies come in and look at approaches. Then it goes to the principals, which are the secretaries, before it goes to the president.
That's where Bannon was, right? They put Bannon inexplicably on the...
They put Bannon on the principals committee, and those of us who have worked on this issue just rolled our eyes and said, what in the world are you doing putting a policy person at the table? Alan, you were essentially giving a policy guy as much power as the Secretary of Defense or the Secretary of State. And that was literally absurd. Now, the good news is now that McMaster is in there as the National Security Advisor and Flynn is out, we are back at the correct posture for the National Security Council. We have a great Secretary of Defense with Jim Mattis. He gets it. He knows the issues.
Yeah.
We have a great National Security Advisor in McMaster. We have a great Secretary of Homeland Security in John Kelly. As you said, these are the generals, and it's really great to have all these good generals. But we also are getting some balance. We have Rex Tillerson at State, and we have some others who are coming in. The problem I see here, Alan, is that the experienced people are all military. The new people who are just learning bring in the balance. And this raises the issue, you know the old line, when your only tool is a hammer, every problem looks like a nail? So we need some balance. We need to think about the other tools of foreign policy, diplomacy, and another one called covert action.
We don't know that there's not covert action, do we?
Well, you know, we talk about this more and more now, because if you think about the tools we have for implementing foreign policy, we have the Marines, we have the guys in the striped pants. There's a whole bunch of things you can do in between striped pants and sending in the Marines, and that's the covert action tool. We need to talk about that because that's a very important tool. In fact, in the war against terrorism, covert action has been the primary tool outside of war zones.
Give us an example of covert action.
Covert action can be as benign as propaganda, or it can be as robust as paramilitary action. An example of covert action, which we all talk about today, is what the Russians did to us during the election, where they tried to influence our election. The key to covert action is being able to plausibly deny that your country did it. So for a while, the Russians were doing okay on that, but we caught them. And we know they did it, and we say we did.
You say we won the war with the Russians, with the Soviets. The question is, we've got Vladimir Putin as the dictator now. What's the big difference? He was a KGB officer himself. What's the big difference?
Well, there's Soviets and there's Russians. Okay? The Soviets were putting forward a philosophy, communism, that was a way of life and that they were trying to impose on the free world. Russia is not doing that. Russia is out for Russia. Russia is out to be the dominant power in the region. Putin's out for Putin and his cronies. They're rich. They're getting richer. Putin's goals are not to turn the rest of the world into Russia. Putin's goal is to have power.
What do you make of the Trump-Putin connection?
Well, I can take that from benign to sinister. On the benign end, I can see that Trump would want to do another reset with Russia. That would be naive at best to think that. But I can get very sinister and say that, maybe collusion's too far to go. But my guess is there's more to come on that story.
Well, everybody's got a theory. And by the way, I agree with you. And I happen to think that if, in fact, there is going to be an impeachment, it's going to end up being about the Russians. So now we have this business where Putin refuses to let us, excuse me, where Trump refuses to let us see his taxes. We know banks in America really don't want to give him a lot of money because he's had bankruptcies. And when you have bankruptcies, you don't pay the banks back. But we do know Deutsche Bank has given him loans. And the question, of course, is who else has given him loans, including in Russia to this day. Got any thoughts about that?
Well, you're starting to open up the basket here to see what's inside. My thought on that is we have professionals who open up those kind of baskets overseas, and we're very, very, very good at it and very thorough. And I think the investigation by the Bureau, supported by the intelligence gathered both through technical means and by human sources, eventually we will see everything that's in that basket.
Really? Do they have the guts to annoy the president, you know, who's sitting on the top of the pile?
Speak truth to power. That is the credo of the CIA. If you don't speak truth to power, we're wasting $75 billion a year.
Well, we may be. That's what I'm
possibly
worried about.
I can tell you this. In my third of a century there, I never saw the agency shy away from speaking truth to power.
Really?
At the analytic level. Absolutely.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are going to take a short break, but I want to encourage you to call and talk to our wonderful guest today. He's been spent all his time at the CIA, and it really is Dr. Jim Steiner of the Rockefeller College of Public Affairs and Policy at the University of Albany. Jim is exactly the guy you need to talk to and ask your questions to. We'll take a short break, and we'll be right back.
Support for WMC comes from Lerac, striving to promote arts and culture throughout the region with their gift shop, featuring locally handmade goods and gallery with exhibits and more in downtown Glens Falls. LARAC.org for details. New England Hydroponics, the indoor gardening experts, offering a full selection of hydroponics, organic soils, and indoor gardening equipment, Southampton and Framingham, Massachusetts, online at nehydro.com. Amherst Copy and Design Works, offering printing and copying, sign making and design services, from booklets to stationery and labels to lawn signs in downtown Amherst, Massachusetts, amherstcopy.com. The Department of Theater Arts, SUNY New Paltz, presents Shakespeare's The Comedy of Errors, a farce about identical twins separated at birth, April 20th through 30th, newpaltz.edu/theater. And Capital Roots, serving the Capital Region's urban communities with access to fresh, affordable food through the Veggie Mobile and Veggie Mobile Sprout mobile markets, capitalroots.org for information.
And welcome back. We're here with a guy who really knows his stuff, Dr. Jim Steiner of the Rockefeller College of Public Affairs, and served for years and years and years and years and many more in the CIA. We'll go to Sharon in East Greenbush. Okay. Sharon, your turn. Go ahead. Go ahead, Sharon. Hello. Maybe it's not working yet.
I just wanted to say thank you, Mr. Steiner, because I feel better. Basically, I'm so glad I got to hear this program. I'm late for work, and I'm about 1 minute away. So I just wanted to say thank you for explaining everything in such a clear and easy way to understand. And I just feel better, period.
Sharon, thank you for the call. Appreciate it very much.
Okay. Thank you.
All
bye-bye.
Right. So now we're going to give you that phone number because it's your chance to really get involved in this. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Jim, while the calls begin to come in, let me ask you very quickly. I want to ask you a simple question, all right? It's of one word. Syria, question mark?
Yeah, Alan, it's interesting. You talked about the Syrian civil war. And I was thinking about that this morning and how my old colleagues in Washington were approaching this. One of the jobs of intelligence is to make the complex more simple. And you do that by dividing it up into pieces that are small enough you can analyze them. And when I think about Syria, in about 15 minutes, I came up with 10 different conflicts, wars, and issues.
For example,
you mentioned the first one, the civil war, which is primarily ethnic between the Sunnis and the Alawites and the Shias.
Sure.
That one's pretty straightforward. Then, of course, there's the religious, and there are actually two religious wars. The one we're most familiar with, which is the extremist Sunnis, Al-Qaeda, ISIS, against the moderate Sunnis, and then the broader one between the Sunnis and the Shias. So there you're at three. You can then take that Sunni-Shia conflict, and you can look at that also as a proxy conflict with the Sunnis being backed by Saudi Arabia and the Shias being backed by Iran. Now, I'm just warming up, okay? So you can now go to looking at this as a regional conflict. Let's bring in the Kurds, the Kurds, sure. Both in Iraq and Syria. What do the Kurds want? The Kurds really want independence. They'll probably never get it, but they'd love to have a greater Kurdistan. Who does this scare most? Turkey.
Turks.
Turkey is, you know, very concerned. So Turkey's involved. I mentioned Iran, but also that brings in Hezbollah and it brings in Israel. Moving further away, the EU is very concerned, obviously, the EU countries, because of the refugees. And then we get to Russia. Russia wants to be back into the Middle East. It's back into the Middle East through Syria. Then you got to broaden this out. Once we get to chemical weapons, you're talking about the Chemical Weapons Convention and WMD. And then you can't forget Korea. And here we are talking about Syria, and I'm saying this all takes us back to Korea. It's not an accident that within 24 hours after a missile strike on Syria, a carrier task force, U.S. carrier task force, is turning and burning and headed to North Korea.
Couldn't agree with you more. Okay, we got a lot of calls. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Only three people on the phone right now, and we'll breeze through them. So get going, everybody. All right, let's go to Eli. All right, welcome back, Eli. Your turn.
Thank you. You know, I have to question your guest's assertion that the CIA has always spoken truth to power in regards to Mr. Tenet. Many CIA analysts are on record that they explained to Mr. Tenet that Saddam Hussein had no weapons of mass destruction as proclaimed by the administration, and that he had no relationship with Osama bin Laden. And they have said that their knowledge was dismissed, not accepted, and that the administration completely overturned their statements to statements made to the public. Statements made to the public, and that Mr. Tenet did not do the proper bidding, and that he bowed down to the administration and seriously undermined the knowledge of these specific analysts. You know, I wish I had their names here in front of me. I'm away from home. I could cite you, case and verse that you could research.
Okay,
what do you have to say about that?
Eli, that's right. Yeah, we'll go to the guest now. Yes. Jim Steiner.
That's it. I'm done.
Go ahead, Jim.
Yeah. Thanks, Eli. I'd be glad to address that. I was there. I was a senior officer at CIA during that time period. So let me take your questions head on. First, you mentioned two issues. You mentioned Saddam Hussein having weapons of mass destruction, and then you mentioned any possible connection between Saddam and bin Laden. You're absolutely right in terms of there was no connection between Saddam and bin Laden. And you know what? That was the CIA's position. And I saw the CIA go toe-to-toe against Dick Cheney on that issue because there was no reasonably good intelligence making that connection. Now, the other issue, probably the more important one, WMD, that's a more complex issue. I can tell you, having at one point in my career run the Office of Transnational Issues, where I had hundreds of weapons analysts looking at these issues, that the CIA firmly assessed and judged that, yes, they did have WMD. First of all, chemical and bioweapons, we knew they had used them before. What we did not know is that Saddam got rid of those weapons. Secondly, the CIA never, ever claimed that Saddam had a nuclear weapon. What you've hit on here is one of the classic problems of using a plural term when you need to be specific. The term WMD, weapon of mass destruction, includes chem, bio, nuke, and radiological weapons. Okay? The CIA and every other intelligence organization thought that Saddam had chem and bio. Nobody claimed he had nuke. But you had a vice president who talked about WMD and then talked about mushroom clouds. So there's a question between what can the intelligence community do to get policy officials to adequately reflect assessments and what was actually said. Finally, though, I need to be right on the table here, put it right on the table, that the CIA was wrong, as were German intelligence, as was British intelligence, as was French intelligence, because Saddam had gotten rid of his WMD, and that was a huge intelligence failure, and that was a failure of both intelligence collection and analysis.
Did you get wrong, as Eli was asking, did you get it wrong because you were ordered to get it wrong?
Absolutely not. We got it wrong because fundamentally, it was because Saddam had used these weapons before, so clearly he had had them. And secondly, there was an assumption. We assumed that that was such a tough neighborhood, the Middle East, that anyone who had WMD would never give them up. And that's why now we use what are called structured analytic techniques, one of which is key assumptions check. You got to tease out the assumptions in your analysis, and you have to weigh them again and again and again. And in fact, this is why I teach intelligence analysis at Rockefeller College, is to emphasize these techniques that get beyond intuitive thinking to a more deliberative, critical thinking approach.
Okay, Eli, thank you very much. Appreciate your call.
Thank you.
Okay. We'll go to Elizabeth in Clifton Park, and before we do, I'll give the number 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Your chances of getting in now are 100%. Okay, Elizabeth, you're on. Go ahead, Elizabeth.
Hi. My issue is Saudi Arabia. They teach a very extreme form of Islam in their religious schools. Obviously, their behavior towards women is horrible, and they fund so much terrorism. I don't see why our allies, I don't see why we sell them so many millions or billions of dollars worth of weapons, and not even to mention the 9/11 terrorists coming from there. But I think it's the religious schools and the extreme form of Islam that they're teaching. What can be done about Saudi Arabia, and why are they our allies?
Okay, there's your question. Let's get an answer.
Jim. Okay. Well, your information is good, but part of it's a little bit dated. So let's go back to, let's say, before 2003, 2004. You're absolutely right. The Saudis have supported religious leaders in a sect called Wahhabism. It is extremely radical. But there was a deal. The Saudis had a deal that you can teach extremism in your religious schools in the madras, but you cannot conduct any activities within Saudi Arabia. That was a good deal for the Saudis, but it was a lousy deal for the rest of us. That changed after 2004, 2005, when Al-Qaeda turned on Saudi Arabia began conducting terrorist operations against the Saudis. Since then, the Saudis have been stronger. Getting back to why did the U.S. support the Saudis? I'm not a policy guy, but let's face it, for decades we were, since the 70s, so dependent on imported oil that we essentially were the Praetorian Guard for some pretty nasty folks.
You want to come back, Elizabeth, or are you done?
No, that was very helpful. Thank you.
Elizabeth. Appreciate your call. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. And now we go to Greg in Albany. All right. Greg, it's your turn.
Hi, thanks, Mr. Shartok. I just want to thank you and your caller. Thank your speaker for his service to the country. I just have a couple questions. One is the Russian involvement in the Ukraine, where their secessionists are seceding. In your opinion, is that just like a land grab for the Russian oligarchs to get this exclusive seaside real estate for nothing? And also, I was wondering, I see Scott Ritter is becoming more active since after the election, and I was wondering what your thoughts are on his service and him. I know those are two completely different questions, but thank you.
Great. Let me take the Russia-Ukraine. In no way do I want to be an apologist for Russia. Let me put that on the table, first of all. In the post-World War II world, we have made borders sacrosanct and changing borders extremely difficult, which is the way it should be. But now let's do a little history. Historically, Crimea has always been a part of Russia. In fact, the Crimea was moved from Russia to Ukraine during the Cold War. It was moved by Khrushchev. Not surprisingly, Khrushchev was a Ukrainian, and it was just part of an effort to make Ukraine a little bit larger and stronger and Russia a little bit smaller. Nobody ever thought that the Soviet Union was going to end and that these would become independent countries. The irony here is if you had had an open election in Ukraine, in the Crimea might well have voted to go with Russia. That being said, the way Russia has approached this by just grabbing it, which it has also done in eastern Ukraine, which it has done in Abkhazia in Georgia, you know, that's completely and absolutely unacceptable. The sanctions are hurting Russia, and I think they're warranted. More to follow.
Interesting. Now, there is some thinking that has been advanced that it was the CIA who engineered the ouster of the pro-Russian, leader there. There wasn't, he hadn't served out his term. They had thrown him out. He went back to Russia. But the question is, did you guys do that?
As far as I know, no. This charge has been put out there by primarily by the Russians. It's in their interest to have that out there. But the CIA would not try to overthrow the Ukrainian government. There would have been no real reason to do that.
Greg, thank you. Okay, so 1-800-348-2551. We'll go to Kathy in, Saratoga. Okay, Kathy in Saratoga, you're on.
Hi. Thank you very much for taking my call. I've just been hearing lately on some of the YouTube things I watch, I think Keith Olbermann was one, where Trump had actually spoken to Putin about what he was going to do, and that's just frightening to me. I don't know if you know anything about that or can speak more on that.
Well, we do know that there's no question, right, Jim, that that we let the Russians know it was coming. And there's no question that the Russians let Assad know that it was coming. But what Kathy is saying, which is sort of interesting to me, is that she's been hearing that that Putin actually spoke with Trump on this issue.
Well, I wouldn't know whether the two of them spoke directly, but clearly we would tell the Russians this was going to happen. You need to go back to look at what was the purpose of our strike on that airfield. And the National Security Advisor McMaster, when he did his Sunday show, was very clear in saying the purpose of the strike was to send a message, no more, no less. It was not to destroy the airfield. It was not to destroy weapon stocks. But merely to send a really strong message. And that message initially was you cannot use chemical weapons. We are civilized countries, and that is a red line that you cannot cross. In a way, Trump was very lucky that this was his first major foreign policy test, because this was an easy one. This was a softball. The administration had just relaxed its policy towards Assad, saying that he could stay. It was very much in Assad's and the Russian interest just to quietly go about their business, but instead they were in his face. Trump had no choice. He had to react. He had to send a message. And that message had to be sent not just to Assad and the Russians there, but even more importantly, it had to be sent to North Korea. It demonstrates that there are red lines, that if you cross those red lines, the U.S. will act and will act forcefully.
Okay. We're going to take a break, and we'll be right back.
Support for WAMC comes from the Black Sheep Downtown Amherst, a New York-style delicatessen and European-style all-butter-scratch bakery, caterer, and cafe offering fair trade coffee. BlackSheepDeli.com. Vision Excel Eye Care, Lake Katrine. Exams, eye care, dry eye therapy, and now new American-made frames where eyewear is an art. VisionExcelEyeCare.com. Gazebo, Northampton, Massachusetts, an independent lingerie shop specializing in bra and post-mastectomy fittings, providing support to the Pioneer Valley for almost 40 years. The-gazebo.com. Goldham and Hartman Architects, serving residential and institutional clients with architecture designed for resilience and renewability, designed for the next 100 years. CNHArchitects.com. And the Waldorf School of Saratoga Springs, giving children the education and tools for the challenges of an ever-changing world. WaldorfSaratoga.org.
Here we are. We are back, and we're having a wonderful time with Dr. Jim Steiner, lifelong CIA honcho. At the Rockefeller, now Rockefeller College of Public Affairs and Policy at the University at Albany. We were just having an interesting off-air discussion. I don't want to take a lot of time because the phones are loaded, Jim. But basically, I said I thought that it's possible that Trump, you were saying Trump doesn't really seem to have a policy. I was saying, well, you know, I think what's possible here is that he wants people to think he's a sort of a wild card madman, and he'll do anything at any time, so they should be scared of him. And you said you didn't think so.
No, not at all. Any national security policy has to be transparent, not just so that your enemies know where the red lines are, but so your friends know if they can count on you. And I'm going to jump to North Korea, because between you and me, Alan, and our listeners, that is the issue that needs to be focused on. If nothing stops them, North Korea will have the ability to put a nuke on the West Coast before the end of the Trump administration.
An imminent danger.
That's going to happen unless we do something. Now,
What's the something?
Well, it could be diplomatic, it could be covert.
Well, we tried diplomatic.
It could be military.
We've tried diplomatic, we've tried covert, apparently, and none of it has seemed to work.
Well, there are some other things we could do. You know, the Chinese are the ones who can take care
of
North Korea.
Take care of this.
What do you think the Chinese would say if we start urging the Japanese to remilitarize?
I don't think they'd be happy.
I don't think they'd be happy at all.
Any more than they are about our putting up, protective missile shields around South Korea and Japan.
Yeah. What I'm trying to say is I think we have more leverage on China than we're willing to use. So I would like to see, before we jump to nuking North Korea, which is what the military option comes down to, I would like to see us use a little bit more robust diplomacy.
Okay, Jim, there are so many people on the phone. There are 9 people on the phone. I want people on the phone. I want to get to each of them. So if you would be so kind to humor me and just answer in short little machine gun spurts.
Will do.
An unfortunate reference. Okay, we'll go to Richard in Hyde Park. Okay, Richard in Hyde Park, you're on.
Hi, folks. Alan, thanks for having him on, and to our guest. I had a question on, should people who leak information, classified information from the United States, be able to have a defense of upholding the Constitution, such as Daniel Ellsberg, Snowden, Chelsea Manning, or even, from WikiLeaks, I'm thinking.
Snowden?
Well, he mentioned Snowden.
You mentioned Snowden? Okay. Julius Assange?
Yeah, Assange.
Yeah, Assange. Thank you.
Okay. Let me answer, first of all, no. I think that anyone who has been entrusted with a security clearance and access to classified information has some options within the system. The first option is to go to the Inspector General. The second option is to go to Congress. The third option is to resign. But if you're going to arbitrarily make yourself the person who decides what can be leaked and what can't leak, then you need to have the guts to stay here and do it and take what the courts do to you.
How about all of us who believe that, you know, you can't have a democracy without information? These guys, some of us see some of the things that have happened as heroic. You know, why should they go to prison if they want to save their country by telling people what's going on?
If they want to do that, they have a way to do that within the country legally. If that's not good enough for them, then they should at least have the strength of will to say, okay, I'm still going to release it, but I will then battle it in the courts. I'm not going to go off to Russia where I'm going to be a pawn. I'm not going to hide in the Ecuadorian embassy in London.
Okay, Richard, thank you.
Can I follow up, please?
Sure.
One quick follow-up?
Sure.
My recollection, I served in the U.S. Air Force back in the early 80s, and I had a top-secret SCIA clearance. But I was an enlisted man, and the oath you take is to uphold the orders from your superiors. However, for the officers, it's a similar oath, but it's also to uphold the Constitution of the United States. So isn't that a conflict? And how do you have a check and balance on something so secret?
First of all, you're absolutely right. It's the oath to the Constitution. You take that. I took it when I went into the Navy. I took it again when I went into the CIA. The Constitution and the laws of our country, which are very clear, if you're going to violate those laws, and I'm not saying that there aren't occasions when you should violate the law, but I'm saying if you are going to violate the law by leaking classified information, then you need to show the strength to be willing to take the consequences of that.
Well, as the old saying goes, that's easy for you to say. Yeah. Okay. Ladies and gentlemen,
all right, thank you.
Thanks an awful lot. And let's go to Alan. In Freehold. Alan in Freehold, you're on.
Thank you. Question of whether presidents listen to what the CIA tells them, and specifically I think about Reagan and about Bush, but Reagan chose the born-again boys to oppose the Soviets in Afghanistan, and Ismail Khan, Bin Laden, Hekmatyar ended up destroying Kabul. Was that done? Was Reagan going with this bunch? Was that done with the blessing of the CIA or in opposition or what?
Well, your initial question on does the president listen to intelligence, and the answer to that is sometimes.
Okay.
The president's a policy guy. The intelligence supports his decision, you're going to find presidents always listen. But there are some times when the president will disagree, when all policymakers will disagree with the intelligence. And if you think about it, it's pretty logical why. They say that, well, I'm in the policy world. My policy is going to change the reality out there. So they believe that their policy will change the future, and that the intelligence assessment doesn't take that into account. That's always the policymaker's option, but it does not change at all the requirement on intelligence, which is to give the best straightforward assessment of their view, their judgments on current and future situations.
Was Reagan's choice of people to oppose the Soviets. Was that done with the blessing of the CIA?
Well, if you're talking about what was done in Afghanistan, that was essentially a covert action, as a matter of fact. It was done by the book. It went through all the different policy reviews, policy approvals at the National Security Council. It was also briefed in depth to the Congress. The Congress provided the funding for it. So, you know, that was a presidential initiative fully supported by the bureaucracy and supported by the Congress.
What about now? Go ahead.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
In retrospect, would you say that that choice was a good one?
My personal view, that was a very good choice. But at the end, when the Soviets pulled out of Afghanistan, so did our funding. So did our funding for Pakistan. So did our funding in Afghanistan. And I think I know where you're going, that bin Laden and company, that's how they got their start. And you're right, but it didn't have to be that way. That was a lack of follow through.
Yeah.
Okay.
One very short question. Was Bush, when we went into Afghanistan, he said, you know, he's going to bomb Kabul back to the Stone Age. Hekmat Yar had already done that. Was Bush that ill-informed?
I think at that point, Bush was playing to a national audience that had just suffered a huge attack and that was, frankly, in a bloodlust.
Okay. Thank you very much for the very good call. Appreciate it. All right. We're now going to go to Victoria. Yes, definitely Victoria in Amherst, Massachusetts. Hey, Victoria, how are you?
Hi, I'm good. So I'll make this brief. I would love to feel confident about the FBI's investigation, and I wonder if you can share something that would make people feel more comfortable about James Comey's behavior before the election, where he had to come out and talk about Hillary when a lot was known about Russia and nothing was said. It makes it hard as a citizen to say, oh, yeah, that FBI is great. Can you clarify why we should trust James Comey?
That's a really good question. Let me broaden it out a little bit. I would say trust the this sounds really strange coming from a guy who grew up in the 60s. Trust the FBI. What I'm really saying is what is really protecting this country at this point in time is the strength of our institutions. As long as the Bureau, the agency, the Pentagon, as long as these institutions remain strong, retain their vigor, retain the support of Congress and the people, we can weather individual leaders who some of us are not real thrilled with. But it's got to be the institution. I think if Comey were to roll and do less than a full job, you would get a lot of FBI agents coming out and making that clear. If that's leaking classified information, I think you would have FBI agents who would be willing to suffer the consequences to play off of an earlier question. But I think it's that strong an institution.
And you're not at all worried about Comey going up to the White House and spending an hour with the president?
Absolutely not.
Really? So let me just add, I mean, I think the New York Bureau and Giuliani's involvement and how widespread this seems to be does the institution that was left out, I think, is the media. I think they are the ones who are really pushing a lot. I hope it's the other institutions, but I guess that's where I feel like I can trust the media, but the FBI right now I'd love to trust. I just think it's hard.
Victoria, thank you so much for the call. Wonderful to hear from Amherst, one of our favorite places. Okay, let's go to, Paul in Kinderhook. Okay, Paul in Kinderhook, you're on.
Hello, Alan, and hello, Ms. Professor Steiner. In the context of the White House recently saying that they were going to, it sounded like they were going to make a rapprochement with Assad and say, okay, he's going to likely be the leader. Shortly after that, there's the sarin gas attack on Assad's people. What's the chance that it's a false flag attack? I couldn't understand in the context why it would work for him to do that to his own people, but it certainly served ISIS because it took the pressure off of them. If suddenly the U.S. joined the fight on Assad's side against ISIS, that was definitely going to swing the balance. And all of a sudden now this gas attack has seemingly fractured that particular war.
Well, you're certainly not alone in wondering about that. I do not have any insight, special insight into the intelligence, but I did hear within the last hour before the show started that the intelligence community is highly confident that it was not a false flag attack.
What does that mean, false flag?
A provocation. It means that some people would argue that it was a rebel group, maybe ISIS, maybe...
pretending there was somebody else.
Yeah, hitting their own people, but making it appear that the Assad regime did it so that the U.S. would essentially come in and go against Assad.
But certainly Assad has done it before, right?
Yes, Assad has done it before. He's done lower level not that long ago. You know, I don't have special insight into any current intelligence on that, but the intelligence community is saying that. I have to admit, Paul, it was an incredibly stupid thing for Assad to do, and Assad and the Russians are usually not that stupid.
Okay. Well, thank you, Paul.
Thank you.
Okay. Yep. We only have a few minutes left, but I want to make them all count. Let's go to, Jill in Waterford. Okay, Jill in Waterford.
Hello, Hello.
Jill. Hello.
Hi. A little while ago, you said that Trump was very correct in bombing Syria after they had used the chemical weapons. My question is, was Obama wrong? And when I say wrong, I really mean wrong, because a lot of people say that Obama was weak for not bombing Syria, but I think it takes more strength to be diplomatic than just go off and bomb somebody. But was he wrong not to do the same back in 2013?
Okay. First, let me clarify, I think, what I said or what I should have said about Trump. Trump was right to send a message and use a kinetic fashion to do it, bombing. The test for Trump is going to be what happens next. Mm-hmm. What happens when barrel bombs go off? What happens if there's another chemical attack? You know, this reaction was as simple as you can get. Cruise missiles can't get into an air-to-air fight with Russians. You don't lose pilots when you use cruise missiles, so this was very straightforward. Was Obama wrong not to follow through? Unfortunately, I'd have to say he was, because when you declare a red line, you have to be ready to show your reaction to that. Now, I happen to think getting rid of a lot of the Syrian chemical weapons, which Obama and others helped make happen, was a very good thing. Also, it might have been a little more difficult to attack the weapon stockpiles, which is what Obama was talking about, because then you can have accidental release of large quantities of chemical weapons. But at the end of the day, I think Obama and company became what they call paralysis by analysis. It's such a complex situation that looking at the 10 different wars going on there kept you from stepping back and saying, wait a minute, he used a chemical weapon. There's only one reaction to that, and that is a kinetic reaction.
Okay, thank you very much for your call. We're going to go to Marty in Fisher, and it is going to have to be a one-sentence question, Marty. Are you capable of that? Can you live up to that?
Yes, a real quick question. I'm wondering just how powerful North Korea is at this point, and what would the fallout be of a failed assassination attempt by the U.S. in North Korea?
And you, sir, Jim, have only one answer to that.
Korea is unpredictable and powerful and has South Korea in its sights.
Okay?
Yeah.
All right. Thank you very much. All right. We're just about out of time. I want to apologize to Jim and Gary. You know, I mean, we just can't get everybody in. Call early and call often from now on. We're just about out of time. Thanks to everybody. I also want to thank Jim Steiner of the Rockefeller College of Public Affairs and Policy, University of Albany, for joining us today. Support for the Vox Pop comes from Elements Hot Tub Spa, downtown Amherst, Massachusetts, offering hot tubs in 5 indoor or outdoor private rooms, plus a team of massage therapists for individuals and couples. ElementsHotTubSpa.com for gift certificates and photo gallery. The Albany Pine Bush Preserve, presenting opportunities to the Capital Region to engage in conservation science lecture series and citizen science participants helping collect data and research. AlbanyPineBush.org and the Poughkeepsie Farm Project, working to connect good farm and community. Oh, I'm so sorry. Working to connect food, farm, and community. Organically grown CSA shares now available for the 2017 season. FarmProject.org. Grapes and Grains Wine and Spirits, East Greenbush, New York. Specializing in wine and craft spirits for more than 15 years. Stocking single malts, bourbons, tequilas, and gin. GrapesandGrainsWine.com. Thanks to everybody. Our engineer has been Zach Malloy. Your calls were answered by the wonderful Susie Checkeye. Our producer is Jim Lavoulis. I'm Alan Chartok. Tomorrow on the show, we'll discuss real estate. Stay tuned now for a news update.